TLS is go for main engine start.
Go at throttle up. Negative return.
I wish I had that intro from last time. What are you going to do?
No. And we see a nominal Miko. Welcome to space.
Cue you, Jake.
Hello, Anthony.
Hello.
How are you?
This is the second time through the intro because I didn't hit the button the first time.
Yeah, a bit of a
and
false
everyone
start.
Will just have to imagine the most amazing intro that you've ever heard on
it
an
was really
nominal
good.
Show.
You know, like when you have when Blue Origin launches New Shepard and they're like counting down and it gets to like 10 seconds and then there's just like a short hold and you're like, oh my god, what's wrong? And then 7 seconds later, it just starts up again and everything's fine. This is
that
exactly
us.
What just happened with Phenomenal. But
good news is I noticed immediately. And I didn't notice a half hour from now.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. You did a great intro last time. Please try again.
I'll say it again. When you started a podcast, Anthony, about space and beer with me, did you ever imagine that there would be a guest so well curated for this show?
Not at all. And we both, I was mentioning this 5 seconds ago, we both got emails separately from Chris about his book and both immediately said to the other, this is the next Off Nominal episode, right? And it was immediately like, yeah, this is the thing that needs to be on Off Nominal. So, Chris, welcome to the show. We are kindred spirits of various space and beer media. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Great to be on. I'm glad I could help serve as that perfect guest for your show. You've achieved perfection now.
The funny part is early on in... I think it was like probably one of our first few episodes, Jake, where we got contacted by a brewery. Was it Ninkazi Brewing?
Yeah.
Name right? We got contacted by this brewery out in, I think they're in Oregon.
They are.
Sounds right.
Okay, you're aware of this. So we actually, on one of our first couple episodes, we drank the beer that they sent the yeast to space on a suborbital rocket and then brewed it. And they sent us a couple of bottles.
Yeah, ground control.
That's the one. Yeah, that was probably like, I don't know, episode 3 or 4 of the show. So I don't know where our sponsorships have gone since then. But,
nowhere.
Yeah. So I was thinking about that. I was reading the book, which we'll get into. And I was like, oh, yeah, remember that time that we drank beer that went to space? So that was these are just high points in our off-nominal career so far.
Yeah. So, Chris, what are you drinking today?
I am drinking an appropriate, I'm drinking wine, actually.
Oh.
It's an appropriate one. It's Olsen Pinotage, and there's a great space backstory to this. Greg Olsen, one of the private astronauts, paid his way up to ISS a number of years back, owns a South African vineyard, and manufactures this wonderful Pinotage. So as far as I know, Greg is the only person who's been in space who produces at least a mainstream wine.
Huh.
That's a pretty select few, right? Like I don't know when the next person that would do that would be.
That's kind of like in Canada, if you ever go to the Niagara region, there's a whole bunch of wineries there, and they're just like regular wineries. And then every once in a while, as you're driving down the highway, you spot a sign that says it's the Wayne Gretzky Winery, and you're like, there's got to be a very select amount of like superstar hockey players who have made wine before. And that's the same vibe I'm getting from that one.
Well, there are a lot fewer people have been in space.
Yes,
true. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Anthony, what do you got?
Last time we did this, I was lamenting the fact that I could never find space beer in my local shop. And then I went in today and there was one from Captain Lawrence Brewing Company, which I think I've had one of their beers on the show before, but this one's called Interstellar Fog.
Nice.
And it's got this like sort of got this look of Luke Skywalker flying down the channel in the Death Star.
Stay on target.
Yeah, it's kind of got that vibe to it, so I'm into it. I'm really digging it. It's tasty too. It's got like Simcoe and all sorts of other stuff. Great.
It's got stuff in it.
Yeah, it was my first sip, so give me a break. I didn't complete the tasting yet.
All right.
And it's tall boy, so it's closer to Jake's size. But it is early. This is an off-nominal matinee edition, so this is like noontime out on the West Coast, so I'm curious to see what you're about to unveil here.
Oh, that didn't
just
bother
regular?
Me at all. Didn't bother me at all. I got a Jake's size one here. So it's not space-themed, unfortunately, but this is from Bridge Brewing, which is here in Vancouver on the North Shore. This is called Make Hay While the Sun Shines, and it's a super hazy IPA. I cannot see through the bottle. It's pretty intense.
That's that Bridge one. Didn't you have one of those before?
I've had Bridge before on the show.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
cool.
It's a farmhouse IPA, and I wanted something nice and thick, but so here we go. I've never had this one before, but yeah.
So oh, where are yeah, we starting with this? Thick. We Jake, I don't know if you've got a chance to read the book. I'm about halfway through it. I'm approximately to modern era in your beer and space section of the book, Chris.
Yeah.
So got a lot of backstory, including a long article section on my my local doctor Benjamin Rush right here in Philadelphia, who's got like you've got a picture of one of his like things that were saying don't drink hard liquor, just drink beer and wine, you won't be an alcoholic, which I was
hardened spirits.
Yeah, yes. Just enjoying that. He's also into bloodletting and stuff, so he didn't really have a lot. I mean, he was, you know, he had some good ideas with like the whole declaration thing and all that, but generally on when it came to scientific pursuits, we're like, all right, listen, Benjamin, we gotta get our drink on however we like. So
Well, Benjamin Rush, and to be a little background for people listening, it goes through, it talks about the history of alcohol in society, civilization, then science fiction, then into the real stuff, like history of drinking in space, as well as companies and organizations manufacturing alcohol right now with the space, you know, with the goal of manufacturing in space. But Benjamin Rush actually liked beer and wine. He was all for that. That was therapeutic. It was just distilled spirits he was opposed to. And so if you see in the book, there's a thermometer basically has for how bad alcohol is. And basically wine and beer are perfectly fine. But when you get into the hard spirits, that's when things go downhill. And I believe when you know, like down at the very bottom, the worst phase, if you like having a morning dram, you're likely to become homicidal, suicidal, and end up in the gallows.
Well, we know our future's ahead of us then at that point. I was enjoying the table setting of civilization and alcohol, because it does seem, when you start thinking about it at that level of alcohol in space, you start realizing how many of the things that it takes to produce alcohol are like the critical path for setting up civilization in space, right? And you talk a lot about how resource intensive it is to create alcohol, and how Andy Weir even mentions it would not have been a useful way to spend potatoes in the Martian to produce vodka. But then when you really think about everything that we need to create alcohol, it's everything that we need to survive on other planets. And that was a cool way to think about it, you know, because when you say it, people go, it's frivolous. Like when you're going so far away, you might not need that kind of stuff. But then you realize all of the components are exactly what we're working towards day to day in space.
Yeah, absolutely. It's first off, it's been hand in hand with the advancement of civilization from the very beginning. So the thought to say, we're going to suddenly stop consuming alcohol when we go into space is crazy. You know, and so let's assume that it's going to happen, particularly as the private sector is getting more and more ambitious in space. You know, people are going to, you know, want to consume a drink of alcohol and eventually manufacture it. But as you said, throughout history, it has played an integral role in the development of society as a whole. Many people think, many scientists or scholars believe that the desire to produce alcohol may have advanced early agriculture more than our need for food. So in many ways, we can thank alcohol production for civilization. And so, but like a good example for space, and yeah, people will think, well, it's kind of frivolous. Do we really need to be thinking about that? Well, I think yes, because since it is inevitable, it's fair game. But when you have companies like, for instance, a good example right now is Budweiser. The American beer maker has sent up 4 experiments up to the International Space Station for barley to see if they can actually manufacture their product eventually in space. They've declared they wanted to be the first beer manufacturer on Mars. Well, it's interesting. It's really exciting to hear that. It remains to be seen whether they will be, but they are investing directly in a capability, a technology that's required for sustainable human habitation in space, agriculture. So I think that's a great thing when you have non-traditional companies investing in space technology that have implications well beyond their product. And so we need more of that, not just in alcohol, but other companies that are looking at problems in a different way. How can we benefit our product? But it might also look at one of these big issues, big problems in a different way. And I'm really excited when these sorts of things happen.
It's probably a pretty good sign of health for a space economy when you have such kind of a diversity of companies interested in using space infrastructure, right? Like that's kind of what stands out to me when I hear about Budweiser's like, yeah, I have something to do on the ISS. And you're like, whoa, maybe ISS totally is useful. That's like a really good sign to me, in my opinion.
Well, this is the problem. I mean, and sometimes ISS, the International Space Station, folks there don't publicize as well as they should some of the interesting things going on up there. And I don't mean just alcohol, you know, experiments. But there are a lot of interesting innovation experiments. But on the alcohol side, Budweiser's not the only one. I think at my count, there are at least three alcohol-related experiments up on ISS right now, currently. In addition to Budweiser, a couple months ago, 12 bottles of Bordeaux wine were sent up as part of an aging experiment. And Suntory, the Japanese whiskey maker, sent up an aging experiment. One back in 2015, one experiment still up there, another one came down. They've been very closed-lipped about the results of the experiment that came down, but they've certainly invested in this. But they're not even the first aging experiment. Ardbeg, the Scottish whiskey maker, sent up the first whiskey aging experiment to ISS back in 2011. So there's been a lot of activity, and it seems to be building in. There's a lot of building interest about sending payloads to space, but also doing experiments and doing research down here on the planet to advance this goal.
The one thing that I was thinking about with the like how resource intensive it is to produce alcohol, it's similar to a lot of what, you know, the trajectory of spaceflight has been, that you are working on limited resources for everything. So you tend to push technology to use resources more efficiently, to make, you know, life support systems that can recycle more, that can use these processes to get more out of less. And this is a natural extension of that. So it fits so in line with what we've done all along that it's almost nonsensical to say, ah, that won't happen in space, because that's kind of how everything happens in space. And that's, you know, whenever people say, like, why are we spending money up there when we have all these problems down here? That kind of ingenuity is one thing that you can harp on, where it's, you know, you're doing more with less in space. So think about how much better we could use resources on Earth if we use some of the innovations that we create in space back here on the planet. And I love that kind of thinking.
Well, yeah, and it's really essential. I don't want to get too far away from the alcohol theme, but it is all completely relevant, ties in, as I mentioned in the book, particularly in the agricultural area. You know, as we learn how to, in arid areas, if we can create plentiful crops on Mars in this completely hostile arid area, yeah, within atmospheres that we create, but nonetheless, it's not going to be an easy thing, then that technology, that capability can be brought back to Earth and can be used to feed people here on Earth. And this goes, you know, there are a lot of capabilities. Many of the capabilities, technologies required for Mars have a remarkable potential here on Earth for markets, for people creating products to make an awful lot of money, but also to improve the life of people on Earth, whether it be agriculture, synthetic biology, life support systems, and it just goes on and on and on. And so I think, once again, we do a poor job sometimes at showing the direct relationship between space technology and our current society, how we live, the products we use, and basically the benefits we get from it every day, and how dramatic these probably will be once we start accelerating again, go back to the moon and on to Mars. I think it's going to be remarkable. And we'll want a drink when we get there.
Yeah, I can't imagine, like, you know, I've heard you talk a little bit about this in some other podcasts, and you know, there's always a story of Buzz Aldrin doing the communion on the moon, and he drank a little bit. And like, to me, that sounds like a completely natural thing, because after a harrowing descent to the lunar surface in a machine that has never done this before and was built by the lowest bidder, I can't imagine anything more needed than a drink after you touch that thing down. in the Sea of Tranquility. So I hope that there is more of this in the future for sure.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, even though consumption of alcohol has prohibited in space, that's officially prohibited. And as you read in the book, it has happened quite a bit. As far as I know, I haven't heard of any stories of anybody getting inebriated, but there's been a lot.
It's because they can't remember them.
Yeah, that's true. Plausible deniability. Cosmonauts and astronauts, even on ISS, regularly will consume small amounts of usually cognac. People always say, I bet there's a lot of vodka in space. No, it's cognac. That's been the official drink in space for some time now. And they'll often drink it. It's part of this to build up camaraderie, to build up the relations between international crews. When there's a new crew, get together and just have a little shot of cognac. After the Mir fire back in the 90s, it basically Russian mission control recommended that the cosmonauts have a little bit of their special medicine, I think the phrase was, I might be wrong there, meaning the cognac, to calm them down a little bit. So I think within that context, it is actually somewhat beneficial. I think, yeah, they had to be very careful. I don't actually argue with the current prohibition, just to make sure it's kind of controlled. Yeah, we do not want inebriated astronauts, particularly in the current environment, at least anybody who's responsible for driving the spaceship.
Yeah.
Like we don't want our airline pilots being inebriated either. But this is, once again, for something like this, when you're on a long-term mission, you're off, even like in my book, John Grunsfeld, five-time shuttle astronaut, former head of the science directorate at NASA, I actually thought when I was talking to him, he'd be completely against it. But he mentioned, when we're on the way to Mars, you're away that long, this could be very beneficial just to keep, to calm you down, to be able to kind of wind down after a hard day's work. It's just something we should just assume is going to happen. And particularly when we send people up as tourists and, they're private sector people who have no responsibility for flying the spaceship. Yeah, they're going to.
Yeah, you're telling me the Bigelow space hotels are not going to be lit? Come on.
Oh, they will be. And there are companies that are keeping that in mind right now. I don't know if you've gotten to the part that, you already know about ground control, where they made wine based on yeast that was sent up into suborbit on a sounding rocket. But there are other companies that are looking at, have been trying to develop beverages that can be consumed in microgravity, particularly carbonated beverages, because carbonated beverages have a problem. As you know, in 1G on the surface of Earth, the gas rises up and disperses into the atmosphere. In space, it doesn't. It all goes to the center and starts expanding. So when astronauts have consumed carbonated beverages in space, they've reported stomach cramps and wet burps. So they don't. Alcohol manufacturers don't want that when people
those
are
bad enough in 1G. That 0G can definitely not make that any better.
Yeah, so you have, for instance, there's a champagne maker, Maison Mum, who has been developing a bottle, a glass, and they're selecting the right champagne that could be consumed in microgravity. So you could pour it out more authentically, have it go into a little glass so you can sip it, like you would champagne on the ground. They say they want to enhance the conviviality of consuming bubbly in space. And, the special bottle to be able to dispense it into the glass. So that's one company. They've tested it on the European version of the Vomit Comet. And here in Australia, collaboration between an aerospace company, Sabre Astronautics, and a brewery, Four Pines Brewing Company, created Vostok beer, named after the first human spaceflight. And they were trying to find the right balance between carbonation and taste. That's another problem in space, because astronauts report that their taste buds are affected, like they have a head cold. So they want to find a beer that's strong enough to overcome the reduction in taste.
There's a great farmhouse IPA enough. I can recommend for that. It's super bitter.
Yeah. Well, they created Vostok, and they tested it twice, maybe three times now on a zero-G flight here in the United States. So there's other companies looking at these problems as well as companies looking at, can you create glasses? A company creating a scotch glass and a cocktail glass so that you can actually sip it more authentically, so it's not just using the squeeze bottle in space and drinking a little orb of alcohol from, you know, out of midair. But
yeah, but that's pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it would be pretty cool.
There's a certain amount of this that's like you're adjusting to the quirks of zero gravity, and there's a certain part of it that's like, what kind of Instagram would my friends be really jealous of? And sipping cognac bubbles out of free-floating air is of the latter sort.
Yeah, but it would get old after a while. And so eventually, after a few months of that, you're going to want to sit down with your cocktail glass, your scotch glass, and, you know, sip it in that manner. It'll feel more natural, make you feel more at home.
One of the things that we had even someone in the Discord ask about this, Radishes in Discord asked about the algae wine that you mentioned early on in the book as a thing that might be more applicable to the environments that we're going to be out in space. Number one, what the hell is algae wine? Number two, do you think that we're going to have some really fantastic tasting new drink that was created in space for the space environment that people back on Earth might be like, oh man, I want me some of that space algae wine?
I think it's more likely we're going to have a really crappy tasting new alcohol, but people will still want to get that and will spend millions of dollars for that first bottle of really crappy, whatever it is, Martian, you know, Martian whiskey, Martian vodka, Martian moonshine. Maybe that should be lunar moonshine. I don't know. But yeah, I think the thing with algae or something else, right here on Earth, we only use a very small number of potential feedstocks for our alcohol production. We know what works, we know what we like, but it's very small number of crops that we use for alcohol production. However, we can use huge number, you know, pretty much any biomass, as long as you can get access to the sugars and turn it into alcohol, you can. So it might be that we realize that it's an entirely different set of, biomass of crops or other biomass that we end up using on Mars, you know, on Mars or the moon or in microgravity. It may be each one might have a different crop that's better suited. We don't know how different gravities are going to affect this. You know, on the moon, you have 1/6 gravity, on Mars, 1/3 gravity, and obviously in orbit, you have microgravity, essentially zero gravity. And so, you know, we don't know, really have a fully understanding how that's going to impact the overall production of alcohol, fermentation, distillation. We know have some clue on aging, but even that's not complete. Suntory hasn't told us. And Ardbeg's experiment did show a very big difference between the taste of the space sample and the ground sample, and not for the better, but it wasn't necessarily, they don't know if that was really because of the aging and microgravity or the harsh treatment that the experiment went through. It stayed up longer than it was supposed to, and it wasn't handled very well. As you know, it was shaking a lot in, you know, launch, and it shakes a lot in landing, and it went through a lot of other extremes. And so they are pondering, last I heard, they're pondering another experiment to try to compensate for some of these extremes, so they might be able to get a more accurate feel for this.
It makes me kind of wonder, like, well, this is, it feels like kind of the early stages of like figuring out what alcohol does in space. And, you know, the very first kind of the obvious things that you try at first is just like, let's do what we did on Earth in space and see what happens. And then eventually you'll find, okay, the process A doesn't work, but process B does, and you kind of iterate. But I wonder if we'll get to a point where all of a sudden there'll be something that you can do in space that you can't do on Earth, and there'll be like an alcohol of some kind that can only be made in space, and it's like a special thing, and then all of a sudden we're addicted to this stuff, and then that should help.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Now, the question is, if that special thing can only be done in space, will it also survive going to 1G also, or is it, can you only experience it by going into space?
Yeah. Or even there's more practical stuff too, like you know, if you look at what Roman wine bottles looked like, they were that weird short fat bottle that had like a little basket around them because of the way that they packaged them up to send out with their soldiers and stuff like that. And then modern era, we have the skinny tall bottle. And that's because we can pack it more efficiently when we're sending it long distances for transport and things like that. So there might be, you know, a round bottle or something like that, or some of these adapted bottles from the mirror era. That,
maybe square bottles.
Or square bottles. Yeah, like those weird watermelons they have in Japan that they like mold for their own little tiny fridges. There's so many ways that could just shape the way that it's packaged that you would look at and say, oh, that's one of those space wines, because look at it, it's in that square bottle.
Right. Yeah.
And then you have them up on the top shelf of your bar, and you're like, yeah, that's that space bottle up there.
Yeah, that's from.
Well, with a square bottle, it's not going to roll off.
That's true. Yeah, Velcro bottle.
Yeah, Velcro, yeah. Oh, man, that's crazy.
I would love to talk a little bit about the societal differences that you touch on in the book between the way that Americans and NASA see alcohol, the way that Russians see alcohol. French were certainly very opinionated about what they should have on board. And a lot of this seems like our vestigial Puritanism that gets infused into our culture here in the U.S. that we don't want to talk about alcohol. And
well, Puritans drank.
That's true.
They had beer.
But we're just so, I don't know, we're a lot of this conversation sounds a lot to me like the whole sex and space conversation, where it's a thing that NASA doesn't want to talk about. It's never going to be officially sanctioned. But if you look at, if you're interested in humans flourishing in space, we need it. And it's one of those things that's like taboo now, and certainly is when we have three people on board the ISS. But what happens when we get, you know, 20, 30 people in space for long duration?
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, the taboo element. And it is. There are two taboos that I see. There are probably more, but the two biggest ones are this one, alcohol in space. But sex in space is the other one. However, this is the easier of the two. It is far easier to understand the consumption of alcohol, how humans metabolize alcohol in space. Since we know we've already consumed alcohol in space, we just haven't done any official studies of how it affects our bodies. But yeah, with sex in space, that's another inevitability, but it's also much more challenging because, you know, it's not necessarily an ethical thing to experiment with sex in
absolutely
space.
Absolutely, yeah,
you know?
It's a huge ethical conversation.
Yeah, so how are you going to do that except when you actually have an accident in the future? And then, you know, it's going to open up some really big questions. And I don't know how to deal with that one. That one, you know, I can think of a number of options, but still, that one's a challenging one. But with alcohol in space, you know, it's something that we know is inevitable. And so let's hopefully with the onset of commercial spaceflight, we'll at least be able to study it and see officially how human bodies metabolize alcohol in space. We know anecdotally, of course, it probably metabolize it fairly well. Nobody appears to have had any unfortunate issues with it. But on the other hand, they've only consumed small amounts. So we don't know, but it's one of these things that's the problem with this nervousness about it, that, you know, we're actually not doing some, you know, looking at some interesting questions here. But you're right. But as for the cultural differences, yeah, this was one of my favorite parts of the book. And a lot of it, you know, thanks to Jeffrey Manber from NanoRex, who gave a lot of details because he was working in Moscow shortly after, right after the fall of the Soviet Union, when the Russian space program and the United States program started started working together for the first time and working on Mir. And it was interesting just the battles there were on the different perspective of alcohol in space between the Russians, the Americans, and the French. You know,
always comes down to those three at some point in history.
Yeah. And frankly, and it really, you can see this just in how they operate. Like, look at the militaries. The French have bars on their naval ships. They have a very strict outline how to manage it. It's done very responsibly, but they will have that with a very strict way of managing, you know, how much sailors can actually consume each day. The British still allow it. It's a little more limited with the British now, but even until the British actually still had a part of their stipend, annual monthly stipend, was paid off in rum until the early 70s. So it's been a big part of the Royal Navy for, you know, for most of its history. But the United States, you know, in the United States Navy, it's not 100% prohibited. They're actually, apparently, I can't remember the amount of time, but if you have a deployment over a certain...
I think you said 45 days in the book.
Something like that. Yeah. It can have a one beer on a one-time basis, I think.
Yeah, it's so, very strange.
Woohoo! So it is interesting, and this was, apparently, there were some heated discussions, and... you know, eventually the U.S. won out in, you know, this at least official prohibition in space. And so, but it's, we once again, be interesting how this plays out over time, because I know there certainly has some been pushed back over time, and certainly with various countries wanting to, well, show their own cultures in space. And yeah. Like with the French. Wine is an integral part of their culture.
There's certain podcasts that have an integral part of their culture that is beer. And whenever they're looking for a study for larger amounts of alcohol in space, I could probably find at least three names that would be willing to take part in this study just to see what it's like.
Yeah, I'd be happy to go to space and get wasted for science. Yeah.
Wasted although, for science.
Like, I've been hungover on a flight before, and I cannot imagine being hungover on reentry. That's got to be particularly awful, especially if you're in like a Soyuz or something really uncomfortable. That's got to be the worst day of your life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not great for sure.
Probably worse for your crew members.
That's true. Yeah. They're like, you're not sitting in the middle seat. You're sitting in that window seat over there.
It's a fine. You got space covers on your head, so it's not a big deal.
There was one anecdote that I loved because I felt so much like camaraderie with this. And I can't remember the U.S. astronauts that were at play here, but there was a shuttle mission to Mir. I think this might have been the first time that anyone drank on the space shuttle, whether we know that they did or not. But there was a group that went over to Space Lab. And they told the commander, I think it was Hoot up there, the best named astronaut, Hoot. And they were going to tell him that they were going to go drinking on Space Lab. And he said he'd rather not know about this. So they just went off and did their own thing back in the back of the party bus, I guess. But I feel like that's one that somebody had to be up there on Mir going, no one's ever had a drink on the space shuttle before. We got to go do this.
Probably the case.
It feels
probably
like a dare. Like, oh, we could be the first drink on the space shuttle. Let's go do it. I just loved that, like, that snippet of just total, just like such a little, you know, pocket of humanity on this very scientific mission.
And that one didn't take any deep research. That one, I believe that story was actually in an official NASA oral history that was done by who? I can't even remember whose oral history that was, but it was there. But, you know, it's once again one of these things that NASA does not like highlighting, but it is in the official record. So.
Yeah, and the other one that was weird to me, and I kind of forgot this story of Apollo 8, when they put brandy into their meals for the mission, and Frank Borman got real heated about this, and I'm concerned as to why he was so angry about this, and it sounded like the other two were also confused as to why he got so mad. But have you been able to suss out what ticked him off about that to the point that he got so emotional about it?
I think he probably, and I don't know for sure, but I think probably since he was in command, you know, this was one of these important missions. You know, we were getting really close to achieving the goal of sending humans to the surface of the moon. And, you know, all of a sudden you have alcohol. And if something went wrong, you know, he probably feeling that he would be blamed if something went wrong and they had consumed any alcohol at all. I can see this happening because the stakes were so high with this, even though it was a joke. All three of the astronauts were not going to consume. They didn't assume they were ever going to open these in space. But I can see it happening. But yeah, they seem to think it was overreacting a little bit.
Somebody just, Radishes in the Discord, brought up the fact that this was also the time period when Borman had terrible diarrhea that was floating around the capsule. So there might have been more at play. I don't know.
It also kind of sounds like Borman too, though, right? Because Borman was very much a consummate professional. Like he wanted to get the job done, but he wasn't super interested in like actually being in space. You know, like he wasn't like a passionate astronaut. He was like a professional, highly skilled astronaut, and that's kind of about it, right? So
that's true. We're projecting a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, a little more than six months later, of course, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Buzz did actually consume alcohol, you know, on the surface of the moon. And so it didn't take much. It didn't take too much longer for it to actually happen.
The first mission.
Yeah, first mission. But as far as I know, that's the only time that anybody has consumed an alcoholic beverage on another planetary body.
I assume once they were going to bring a rover onto the moon, they were like, well, we definitely can't have alcohol and a car on the moon at the same time.
Who's going to pull them over?
No DUIs on the moon. What is the jail time for lunar DUI? Do you just... You stay up there for a while, they pick you up on the next mission, what's the
deal? It's technically not illegal on the moon, right?
I guess, yeah, there's no laws up there, right? Especially if you're drinking the White Claw.
The White Claw, oh jeez.
It's interesting, though, one of the other sections of the book, you know, I mentioned, you go into science fiction, and it's kind of funny that in Jules Verne's... oh, my brain is what's his moon book? My brain is not from Earth to the moon.
Yeah.
You know, speculates about wine on the moon and whether you can grow grapes and manufacture wine on the moon. First time I believe anybody's ever speculated about that or making alcohol in another planetary body. And a century later, you know, on the first mission to the moon, you know, you have Buzz drinking wine. And no, it wasn't. Buzz was drinking it as part of a religious ceremony. It really wasn't, as far as we know, as part, you know, because he needed a drink at the time. But I think it really was part of this religious ceremony, which he pre-planned with his church in Texas. And they brought the goblet, which the Webster Presbyterian Church provided. And that church still has that. They have it's now in... They do an annual service, a lunar service, where they bring out the lunar goblet that Buzz drank out of and do a service based on that.
That's awesome. That's the best humble brag in the world. Yeah. Like, oh, today is our service with the lunar chalice. Okay, you've won.
Oh, man.
I've also was thinking about, this is jumping ahead in the show a little bit, but I was recently watching season 4 of The Expanse, and since season one, there's been much less of the drinking in space because season one had a lot of the bar on Ceres, was it, that they were always drinking at, the Miller, the cop. And I felt like they always had such a good vibe. I mean, generally, The Expanse, to me, looks like what space exploration would look like if you took out all the robots. And I always appreciated their kind of bar vibe. And it looked a lot to me like... you mentioned in the book as well, the bar down at the South Pole. It was like what, Club 90 South or something
Club
like that.
Club 90 South, yep.
I feel like that was very inspired, or the Expanse's bars were very inspired by that kind of gritty look to it. You know, this dive bar at the South Pole, very remote destination. And there's certain times watching The Expanse when I just go, that's what it would look like. And they certainly do the thing you mentioned with Apollo 11. When Buzz pours the wine, it's, you know, 1/6 G, so it's got this very strange physical dynamic to it that we've never experienced before. And they do that in The Expanse as well with the Coriolis effect being on Ceres when they pour drinks. They get that just, you know, weird to us experience of drinking in other destinations. And that's something that when I think about space exploration, there's these tiny elements that just are so foreign to us that make it so unique. Yeah. And it's really cool.
And there
about.
Must be like a, I'm thinking like drinking has so many idiosyncrasies, like cultural, like traditions and stuff, you know, like I think about pouring a beer and it's like, well, how much head should you have? It has to be just this amount. And this is how you pour a glass. And when you cheers, you have to touch the top of the glass, not the bottom of the glass, and never put your drink down until you've cheers. Like there's all these like weird, like cultural things. I wonder how that will translate to space. And after like a long time.
Yeah, or like Guinness. Like how long do you have to let Guinness sit when it's in 1/6 G? Yeah. It's like an hour and a half at that point.
Well, yeah. And there's so much showmanship to drinking, you know, in bars at times. And think of all the different options of these different gravities. And yeah, you're right with how long the Guinness will need to sit. Although it'd be a whole different problem, microgravity, because...
It wouldn't do anything, yeah.
Yeah, you'd have this big ball of gas in the center. And, it would be really interesting to see how you would consume
it. You'd have to have like a little Guinness centrifuge or something that you spin up, you know? It's maybe like one of those like New Year's Eve things that you spin around and it makes noise, but it just, you hook a Guinness thing in and spin it until it's ready.
And that may be it, you know? So you're right. So it could
Call
be interesting
Guinness.
How
Call
this
me.
All develops. But what do you do with your stomach, though?
Yeah. Yeah, you start spinning Jake when he gets a little too drunk. Cut the gas
like
out.
Being
somebody mentioned the same with wine though. Like you gotta keep the corks wet, right? So you have to have wine in some sort of centrifuge to keep wine against the cork.
Well, not mean most, but most even good wine producers are using synthetic corks or even just using screw-on corks now. And it's, you know, it really doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, but that's not as fun for champagne. You want to be able to shake champagne and then propel yourself around the spacecraft when you open it.
Well, that would be another interesting one. What happens there? Now, that the champagne bottle that Maison Mum is producing, you know, you don't pop off the top. You know, that would be fun. You could have races. If you have a big open space and a couple of champagne bottles, you could have, it's a new sport.
Yeah, totally. Champagne racing. I mean, I've seen Gravity. She does that with the fire extinguisher on Gravity. She gets all the way to the Chinese space station, which makes no sense, but that's a whole other podcast.
Oh, you're saying that movie wasn't authentic?
I hate that movie. It's one of my least favorite movies in the world.
But it's so pretty.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that
one.
It's
so pretty, though.
I don't want to get into it.
Yeah, I imagine, and like, there's got to be a whole... I certainly wouldn't want to be the one that like popped a champagne bottle on the ISS and like covered all of the electronics in sticky champagne, you know? You need like a trap for it at the end of your, like, you pop the cork.
But you
like,
would be the
it.
Guy that opened champagne in the ISS and gummed up the works for a week.
Yeah. For years on end, people
would
be talking
again.
About you.
Yeah, exactly. You go down as a legend, you know?
So Chris, do you have like a favorite story of drinking alcohol in space? Like from all the ones that you were able to research, is there like one that like really like stuck to your heart?
Favorite one of the actual people that have actually consumed alcohol?
Sure. Yeah. Just any of the stories that you found in the research of your book.
You know, it's hard to say. You know, I kind of generally, as I'm going to get back to the people who have consumed alcohol, but I, you know, some of the things I like the most about, you know, the stories about this was just all the innovation, all the innovative thinking. And as it was mentioned earlier, you know, how this is all directly related to us getting humans into space and to the moon or Mars, what it'll take to be able to create sustainable human presence. And this is what my favorite part of the book and researching it and talking to all these really fascinating people and getting all this input. And while it's not a specific story, you know, that you're looking for that, this was my favorite part of the book because how everything connected, and the more I looked at it, the more relevant it became to my day job as CEO of Explore Mars, and how it just completely connected to all of this. And I was able to, I didn't expect so much overlap, and I was able to utilize a lot of the people I interviewed for the book at my last conference, the Humans to Mars Summit, last year, and I'll probably do the same thing this year in Washington, D.C. as well. That just so much interesting innovation going on and looking at problems in a different way that, you know, the regular space community wouldn't necessarily look at the problem this way. And I think that's great when that happens. But as for, you know, I enjoyed a lot of the stories. But, you know, like, for instance, the one you already mentioned on the space shuttle. But also when John Grunsfeld was mentioning, you know, when crews would come together and have... come together and, you know, when there's a new crew, whatever, and just get around the circle and they would just get to know each other. And I think this is a key area, which I think is very important. It's not particularly in the early days, but the space station or Mir, but even now, it's not always easy to have this international crew get along. And so I think when they can have these bonding experiences, you know, utilizing a very small amount of alcohol, I think that's a good thing. I think it's helped diplomatic relations. I think it's just overall has been a very positive thing, you know, once again, as long as it's done in moderation, which it has been from as far as I can tell.
Yeah, and I wonder how much the crew size has to do with the feelings towards these kind of ceremonies, right? Because like you're saying, you don't want somebody who's tasked with commanding a ship to be drunk. But once you get to a point, you know, we're about to have a lot more crew members on board the ISS. If crew size increases significantly and there's some amount of off-duty time where you know, each person is not just stuffed schedule-wise all week keeping the ISS running, maybe things get a little more lax and back towards some of that that more lax feeling towards making sure that the crew's getting along. Obviously, when there's more people on board, there's more opportunity for major strife between crew members. There's a lot more interpersonal relations at play. So that's a story to me that I think we'll see in the next couple of years is increased crew sizes to the point where there are longer durations, bigger crews, and we might start seeing a shift in that kind of relation side of things.
Well, yeah, it's not sustainable the way they do it now, whereas literally they're pretty much on duty all the time.
I was going to say, you kind of need that off-duty time for that to really be a thing, right?
Right.
Yeah, and like airline, going back to airline pilots, they're not on duty all the time. It's very, everybody agrees they shouldn't drink here in the United States within 8 hours. Some other countries, other locations, it's more. But an astronaut, I believe it's 12 hours. But same sort of thing. You know, you still need to be careful, make sure that they don't drink within a certain amount of hours between off-duty and on-duty. But yeah, I think it's, you know, as we start expanding, we start really expanding our presence in space, this normal life starts to occur. What's going on in space and what's happened from the very beginning has not been normal life. And so our goal should be to create some level of normalcy. It might be a new type of normalcy, but it doesn't mean that you're on duty 24 hours a day.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We'll need some big ships for that, I guess.
Yes. Well, Elon seems to be developing one. So yeah,
will there be?
I know he had a pizza restaurant designed into it.
Will there be a 10 forward on Starship? I guess that's the real question that we're getting to here, right?
Elon, if you're listening, please send in an answer.
Yeah, yes. In fact, Elon, we'll do a whole interview about 10 forward if you want. Just let us know.
Yeah, the first off nominal in space is going to be that's a thing that should happen at some point in our lifetime. Yeah. Maybe it could be during the study. You know, we're available.
We're available,
Chris. Yeah, you're probably available.
That would be really cool. I'll sign up for that one.
Totally.
Before we get to picks, Jake, I don't know if we ever gave out instructions for people to go, where should they buy the book? Where's the best place for you for them to buy the book?
Well, they can go to Amazon. It's, you know, they can get it pretty quickly on Amazon. They can go to the publisher's site, which is McFarland Publishers. And most, you know, Barnes & Noble, I think most of the online vendors have it right now. So it's pretty easy to get and it should arrive pretty quickly.
Alcohol in Space, Past, Present, and Future is what you're looking for. I've been doing a Kindle edition, walking around the city, just listening to it a little bit. I did that. You ever use that thing where you can have your phone read your text? It's wonderful.
What?
Just saying. There's a whole thing. It's built in. It turns anything into audio, so I can just walk around. Every once in a while, you just throw your thumb, flip, and it reads the next page for you. It's great.
Wow.
It's awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Living in the future right there.
Okay, so picks?
Picks. Yeah, I got some picks.
You got one?
I have a couple. I feel like I've recently been doing watching all of the space shows picks, but I'm going to finish it out because now I've finished a couple seasons here. Check in on For All Mankind. I don't know if you two have been watching this show. Finished it. Similar thoughts as the last time I talked about this. It was a very cool show. Feels a little unfocused to me. Like there's not a general start to finish plot line, I would say, other than what would the world be like, which is cool, but there's just like all these different little plots. They're all interesting, but I felt like it was a wide show, not a deep show, if that makes any sense. So I was kind of like, okay, let's see. Excited because that's coming back for season two. So I'm in on that show. The Expanse, caught up on season four of that. Season four is okay.
I haven't watched the finale, so like I
okay. The finale?
Finale.
I feel like I've made fun of you for this
yeah,
before.
You guys, okay.
It always throws me off.
The last episode, the ultimate episode of season four, I've not watched yet, so.
Yeah, no spoilers in this. People are worried about spoiler alerts. But Chris, are you watching any of these shows? Are you in on these shows?
I've watched The Expanse. I finished off season four, and I believe there was a drinking scene in that one.
Definitely was. Yeah.
But, I mean, I know it's supposed to be for newer things, but I think I agree with you on the earlier version, you know, that just that whole end the season, but it got a little more fantastical as it went along.
It didn't feel like it moved. I don't feel like The Expanse, the show, is significantly different at the end of season four as it was at the end of season three.
But at that, particularly at the beginning, I think it got that feel for space pretty well. Kind of had a similar feel, and I liked the newer Battlestar Galactica, kind of a more raw feel, that edgy feel, more realistic to what you think people are going to actually act like in space. As much as I like Star Trek Next Generation, everything like that, it's, well, I don't... It's not necessarily how people are going to be acting in space and how humanity is going to be, how society will have developed. Maybe it will have. Maybe I'm just being pessimistic, but I think versions like The Expanse are probably more realistic.
Yeah, and I recently listened to an episode of Planetary Radio with two writers of The Expanse. I think this is a fairly old episode, but they were talking a lot about like the influences for writing The Expanse and things like that, and one of the things they mentioned was like their one caveat was, what if there were no robotics? And I, for some reason, I had not noticed, like, they built the world out so well that I didn't even at all think about the fact that there were no robots in The Expanse. But there's no robots. Like, the one mystical technology they have is that medical chair where they put their arm in and it fixes all of their issues. But there's no robotic things.
Yeah, I'd never given that any thought, but you're
right.
That is cool.
But that was like the one thing they allowed themselves to say. Here's our world. It's no robots. It's crazy. Like, that. What space show can you name where there's no robots?
That's true.
I think Babylon 5.
Okay, there you go.
I don't, but that's, you have to go back a little while for that one. That was another edgy one with lots of drinking as well. But I don't recall any robots in that one.
It's just cool to think about, like, because that's the whole shtick with sci-fi, right? You get to pick one thing that is, like, your suspended reality of the show, and I guess they pick two in, like, the Epstein Drive and the no robots thing, but I just enjoy, I think that's what makes it feel so relevant to our time, where we have robots, but, like, we don't really have robots to the way that most space shows show, and it just feels so gritty and real. I love it. So anyway, that's my Expanse thing.
Perfect.
Watch them. Season 4, but watch them.
So my pick is a pretty simple one, and it's only like quasi-space related. So there's this like cool little interactive web experience that I found called The Deep Sea. And it's not really space related at all, but basically it's like this little thing where you can scroll down and see kind of what there is at different levels of the ocean. And so you kind of like scroll and scroll and scroll, and you get like, here's the animal that lives at this level, here's the animal that lives at this level. And it's like all about this, like, how weird it gets as you explore deeper into the world.
Is this neil.fun?
That's the one, neil.fun.
What a domain.
I'm trying to like post it here. My computer is having some struggles right now, but... so you just scroll and scroll. So like, here are whales, here are fish, here are all this weird stuff. And you go all the way to the bottom where you can see all the different, they put like all the things where like, here's the submarine that has explored the lowest. And here's where this trench ends. Here's where this trench ends. It's super cool. So, I kind of love the presentation of it, which is pretty neat because I'm a communicator. And you can learn a little bit about deep.
Are you going to build a Titan version of this for us?
Yeah. Something like that, for sure. So, yeah, that's my pick.
I'm digging this thing.
Everyone's like browsing it right now. Ooh, scroll.
Yeah,
scroll.
Just, oh, look at this thing.
Chris, what do you got?
Well, I have to admit, I'd forgotten about the picks until you started mentioning it. We're at the lead up. And so I was going to pick The Expanse just based on pretty much the same things you said. I've been racking my brain. What else? What else have I been watching? And, you know, interestingly, most of what I've been doing is researching the next book. But
were there any books? Here, I'll give you a good question that I'm just for my own personal reading list. Were there any books that you were reading in the run up to writing your own that you felt had a good setup for writing about space? Because it is kind of a hard topic to make it relatable to people, to make it relatable to not the super nerds that know everything about space, but make it approachable for people that aren't typically reading stuff. Is there anyone particular that you read that you were like, this is a book to go get?
Well, it's not necessarily a specific book, but a style. I wanted to do it because, as you see in the book, that I also incorporate a lot of research and trying to balance the research. And this kind of comes back to my background. I originally, before I was working in the space sector, I did historical research and I helped a lot of authors writing biographies and history books. And so I liked authors like, say, like David McCullough, who could manage, now not comparing my writing style to David McCullough, but you know, he's in a vastly different category, or you know, but or better category. But I like authors who are able to manage a lot of information, you know, on complicated topics and make it approachable and conversational. And that's what I was trying to do, kind of collect a lot of very well-researched information and write a conversational book based on a lot of actually fairly detailed research. And hopefully I was able to achieve that. And so there, it wasn't any specific book, but just a style and a method that I've seen with my favorite author, historical authors, who are able to write in a way that's not overly scholarly. I think we've read books that, you know, have a lot of great information, but it's hard to read. They're so thick. And they're written for scholars and not for the general public. And I think they only have limited use. You know, they do have a use. They're great. But if you want to reach more people, really get the message out, you need to write it in a manner that people can read and understand, and you feel the story. You get brought into the story. So kind of like in a novelistic approach. You know, easy to read, but also telling a story that anybody can understand.
Yeah, and I think with even my wife, who is tangentially interested in space, I would read her some of the anecdotes from the missions, and just those little snippets of what it was like to have those moments of normalcy when you're up in a space shuttle, in a space station, and all these weird environments they really make you feel like you're there because they're just so human. And I love that's the favorite part of your book to me personally. It's just like, what would it be like if I was up there, you know, for a couple of weeks at a time? And that's the stuff that I love. So I'm anxious to finish the rest of it. I'm only about halfway through, but I'm a slow reader. So I'm doing the best I can. But you mentioned a little earlier the other things that you do day to day in space. So if anyone hasn't heard of that stuff, can you let us know what you're working on day to day in space?
Yeah, I'm the CEO of a nonprofit called Explore Mars. We're one of the most influential nonprofits specifically regarding Mars. And some of the things we do, we run the largest annual conference focused on sending humans to Mars, called, the Humans to Mars Summit. Our next one, with the 2020 Humans to Mars Summit, will take place at the National Academy of Sciences building in Washington, D.C. on May 12th through 14th. And this is always a great event. We always have senior NASA officials. We've had the NASA administrator from the very beginning of the conference each year, and it's changed, of course. Now we have Administrator Bridenstine. And he hasn't confirmed yet this year, but hopefully he will be speaking. But
it's tough to schedule.
What?
He's tough to schedule sometimes.
He is, but he does. He does come to a lot of things, and he's been very good to me, you know, coming to our event. Actually, we were the first public event he came to after he was confirmed as administrator.
I remember that. Yeah. It was the big to-do. JB's here. We call him JB. He's welcome to the JB fan club.
So we were happy about that. But we always have, you know, wide range. And this is where, kind of related to the book, we always have the top people in mission architecture and science, we also like to expand it so that you have different technologies. We have innovation companies, you know, looking at how you can use blockchain and space exploration, agriculture. Last year we had a Feeding Mars panel similar, and that was inspired by the book research, where we had people talking about synthetic biology, agriculture, you know, a company talking about cell-grown meat. And 3D printing. We also have other, you know, try to find as many different interesting technologies that we can, and industries that can be brought into the community. Some of them know they have something that's valuable for space exploration. Some of them have never given it any thought and realize, oh, you're right, this could be used for that, because they're looking at it in a completely different way. And so one of the roles we see is to bring these communities together, to force them in the room and have them start discussions, because many of them have never, you know, communicated with each other. And this isn't just with vastly different industries. we've often played this role even within NASA itself. I mean, I remember our first few conferences, we've had people coming, like our first ISS and Mars conference, basically trying to see if ISS, how can we utilize ISS to get to Mars? We had people who had literally worked in the same building, NASA headquarters, two floors apart for 20 yeah. years, who had never communicated. And they had very, very much related disciplines. They had similar jobs, but they never spoken to each other. So it took our conference to get them to talk to each other. So that's one of the things we like to do, bring these communities together. And we run these very important workshops, a lot of STEM education work. We're about to launch a bunch more. We just brought last year our new president, Janet Ivey, who does television show Janet's Planet, and is one of very, very well-known STEM evangelist. And we're about to launch some really interesting new technical project in partnership with a major technology company. Can't go into details on that. So we're very active, and we have a big year coming up, particularly since it's the year of Mars. Four international missions going to Mars this year. And so it never happened before, so much activity. NASA sending their 2020 rover. Europeans partnering with Russia sending the ExoMars mission. The UAE is sending their HOPE mission, their first mission. And China will be sending a mission to Mars as well. So a convoy going to Mars, robotics, but very important missions this year.
Jake was so excited for those missions that he quit his job and is now technically a full-time podcaster. Do you want to do a little Going Pro update, Jake?
Well, our campaign ended, so thank you to everyone who supported it. It's been really overwhelming. We really, like, the last day was crazy and hectic, and we were doing a Twitter countdown to our milestone of 200 patrons, so it was super cool. I'm overwhelmed. So now I got to do all the hard work, though, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's a busy year.
That was the fun part
for the Mars beat.
Is preaching about it and then you know, getting supporters, but... yeah, it's been really good.
Well, I'm pumped for partaking in the Mars beat, but not being day-to-day on the Mars beat. I am excited to sit back and enjoy 2020, personally, while you two are very busy. Have fun with that.
Cool.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming on. It's been awesome to talk with you, and I'm excited for more alcohol in space, for more Mars stuff. Hopefully, we get to meet in person someday. And we didn't connect... in IAC, if you were at IAC, there was about 300,000 other people there. But
you should come to Humans to Mars Summit.
It's not a far drive for me, so it's not out of the question.
That's an easy one if you're in Philly.
Yeah, it's pretty close. So
I do hope to come up and do a book talk in Philly sometime.
Oh, let me know. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, or if you have ideas. I was going to reach out to some of the Astronomy on Tap people and others.
Oh, that's a good one. Yep, I can send you some lists because I've got a couple of friends in the city that do that kind of stuff. So that would be awesome.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Bye, Jake. Jake, you're supposed to say
bye.
Bye. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.